I'm your host, Michael Callahan. This is Where We Go Next. And climate change can feel like an abstract, insurmountable problem that is either so extreme that it's going to wipe us all out within a decade or two, or there's nothing we can do about it anyway, so why even try? But what if there were incremental, actionable solutions we can implement locally, rooted in the knowledge of people who've experienced the consequences of climate change up close? Our guest today has done years of on-the-ground interviews and research into this very issue, and he shares what he's learned with us today. Jonathan Vigliotti is an Emmy and Edward R. Murrow Award-winning CBS News national correspondent whose work has appeared on CBS Sunday Morning, Face the Nation, and 48 Hours. And he's the author of Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Well, I'm glad that it's a pleasure all around. Now, you opened the book on August 9th, 2023, as you arrived in Maui to cover the wildfires that took at least 101 lives as of this recording. And I just have to say, I have to get this off my chest, the complete lack of accountability for the death and destruction from seemingly anyone in state or local government was and is to me abhorrent. I watched videos of you questioning the mayor of Maui, Hawaii's adjunct general, and the director of the emergency manager agency. You were on the ground in Lahaina less than 24 hours after the wildfires completely decimated it. You spoke to the victims who lost everything. What was it like being in those press conferences, looking those officials in the eyes as they denied culpability?
It's a great question. Let me give you some context before we get to where it all ended with local leaders so that those who are listening that may not be familiar with Lahaina understand what was going on in my mind. I got the call very early in the morning around 4 a.m., less than 24 hours after this fire decimated Lahaina, and was launched to, at the time, our only understanding was a wildfire had ripped through part of Hawaii. When we arrived in town as one of the first network correspondent teams to be there, we didn't just drive in. We ran into a roadblock for the one road into town, about a 13-mile long road. Police told us it was simply too dangerous to access the scene. So we waited by this roadblock where we did some of our initial reporting, and we were joined by survivors, residents who had escaped, who were trying to get back in but were prevented from doing so. And they told us at the time that the reason journalists weren't being allowed in was officials didn't want us to cover and really investigate what they were describing to us as a failed emergency response. At the time, we weren't sure if that was frustration, if that was anger, which is understandable, but we decided to charter a boat to bypass that roadblock. And an hour and a half later, we were dropped off on this cindered shoreline. And in my book, I describe what we saw as an environmental holocaust. Home after home, business after business decimated. We're talking entire neighborhoods. The first 30 minutes that we were there, we saw a number of survivors who were walking around surveying the damage of what they survived and what little was left of their neighborhoods. People in a state of shock, as you can imagine. Some people really looked like ghosts with ash on their face. We did not see a single first responder in that first day. As we listened to people's frustration specifically over what they were describing, and this is less than 24 hours into this disaster, a lack of any kind of help from officials. There were no evacuations that were issued. Many people had no idea there was a fire burning in this town until they saw it out their windows. We made several trips back and forth to Lahaina by boat and eventually by car before FEMA arrived, and they taped off the entire disaster zone. And in those 3 days, we got a better understanding of this quote-unquote failed emergency response as we spoke to people. One woman who was a manager of a local hotel who tried to escape, she saw smoke, but she also saw a backup of traffic, and she knew that she wasn't going to be able to make it out. So she turned back around and she went to her hotel where hundreds of guests who also could not evacuate were stranded. There was no power. There was no water. There was no cell service. So no understanding of what was truly going on. And so they waited for first responders to arrive. A day goes by, nobody arrives. Food starts to run out, and they had to actually ration off what little was left for kids. Day two goes by, and they still held out hope. They were only a mile and a half away from an airport. Behind this hotel was a dock into the ocean. And so they thought somebody would knock on the front door of this hotel. That never happened. On the third day, this woman then decided that she was going to get into her car, not knowing what she was driving into, and drive down that 13-mile road. And she was surprised to see there wasn't a single down power line or tree blocking that road. She didn't see a single first responder. This is day three. And she eventually, 13 miles later, praying to God to protect her along the entire journey, she arrived at that same roadblock that we had bypassed days earlier. And she was frustrated to see a long line of cars with volunteers, citizens with food and other supplies trying to get through, and they were prevented from doing so. I don't know, Michael, if you remember these images that I saw when we were walking along historic French Street. It puts into more perspective what people faced. The line of cars frozen in a state of some kind of traffic jam. They were all burned down to their metal structures, their metal frames. These were people who, because there was no emergency evacuation, they took matters into their own hands to try to outrun the flames. They were quickly surrounded by them, and so many people had to jump into the Pacific Ocean. All of this background brings me now to that press conference, the first one, the second one, and the third one, and they continued, where we listened to local leaders who described this fire as an explosion. The quote that I heard them say so many times was, "It was like a bomb going off," as if to imply there was no time to take action. But as we soon learned and began to report, there was a nearly decade-long fuse that could have been put out at any point, because in 2014, 9 years before this devastating fire that decimated 80% of the town and, as you noted, killed, at least at this hour, 101 people, because efforts still continue on, this report by scientists in 2014 warned that the warming atmosphere was warming up the island, increasing the vulnerability to wildfire. They even had suggestions for how to prevent a disaster like this, including restoring wetlands, which had been depleted because of population growth, conserving water, which had been tapped dry because of that population growth and a booming tourism industry. They also suggested removing dry, invasive grasses, which had overrun part of the island and had turned the area into a tinderbox. They went even further, suggesting that homes use sustainable and fire-resistant materials when building or updating materials that qualified for tax credits and, when used, would have reduced insurance costs. But this report was essentially filed away, and as we learned, no action was taken, even though there was federal funding available to these local leaders and to these communities to implement some of these changes. And so these warnings, unheeded, became this self-fulfilling prophecy. And as I talk to you, and I'm sure listeners are wondering, well, how can you say, or how do you know, if that report was listened to and if those actions were taken, that there could have been a different outcome? Well, I walked, and we were one of the only crews to be able to do this in those early days. I walked the entire length of historic French Street. All of it was destroyed. And in this miles-long path of destruction, there was one home that remained still standing unscathed. It's what locals know today as the house with the red roof. And this home, the homeowners had recently updated it, and they implemented those scientific remedies outlined in that 2014 report. They removed dry invasive grasses. They removed brush and trees that were too close to their home. They put stone rocks, kind of like this stone moat, around the house with river stone. And what that did essentially was it prevented fire, which that day burned the grass. It allowed it to prevent it from reaching the foundation, because once the flames reached those stones, it just went out. And the most important thing they did, perhaps, was put a red metal roof on their house. So when the flames did fall on that roof, they weren't able to actually light the house on fire. And as I've learned in my reporting, and as we can discuss, every disaster by different names across the country has a similar home, a home with a red roof. And all of these homeowners share one thing in common. They listened to guidance. They listened to science. And they took action even when local leaders weren't. We need more homes with the red roof so that more communities can withstand the threat that our extreme weather, radicalized by climate change, continues to pose.
In an era of increasing misinformation and conspiracy theories, it can often be difficult to parse truth from fiction, but I try to keep an even keel. But I will say, watching the press conferences last year, seeing the news reports, hearing about the police blockades that prevented people from escaping the very fire that they failed to prevent that was eating them alive, And then again, reading this book and seeing all of the warning signs, all of the prescriptions that were ignored. Jonathan, I don't consider myself conspiratorial, but I cannot understand how something like this came to be when everything was looking these officials in the face and telling them, this is going to happen. Here's the money to solve it. Here's what you need to do to prevent it. And just everything was ignored.
The threat that climate change poses to societies, especially here in the United States, it can be abstract. It can be hard to process. And I don't think any of these local leaders intentionally ignored the science, intentionally didn't take action to protect their communities. I think there was a failure to imagine a worst case scenario. I think there was a failure to process the information that they were receiving, to understand it, and to figure out a way to take action. And in doing so, as you mentioned, there are a number of conspiracy theories that were sparked by this fire, including things as crazy as lasers that were being beamed down that started this fire. I can assure you none of that
lasers. All right.
Took place.
James Bond. Yeah.
I mean, the cause here was much simpler, and it was just overlooking the information that was provided. And you had mentioned the head of the local emergency management agency, his name, Herman Andaya. At that point, he was the head. And he made the decision not to sound the sirens. There's questions as to where he was at the time. We know he was off the island on another nearby island at an emergency preparation conference, of all things. What he was doing, where he was doing, and how tuned in he was to the situation that was unfolding on the ground in Lahaina, unclear. But I spoke to him at one of those press conferences, the first one that he appeared in, and I asked him if he was qualified to do his job, getting to the point of where he was at the time, and if he regretted his decision not to sound the sirens. There are sirens that are placed throughout the island for tsunamis, for things like wildfires, for volcanoes. This is all on the state's website. This is what these sirens that cost millions of dollars to put in place are in place to do. And he said he did not regret his decision to sound those sirens. And so many people we spoke with said had those sirens gone off, they would have had a chance to evacuate much sooner. They would have known that there was a fire burning outside their homes before they saw it with their own eyes out their own windows. And so I think the lack of emergency response, the fear and the panic that ensued, none of it was driven by conspiracy. It was unfortunately much simpler than that. It was a failure to listen and a failure to imagine. As terrible as all of this is, it presents an opportunity for other communities to see this and to learn from mistakes that were made. There are things that we can do. As outlined in that 2014 report, which I know is specific to Lahaina, but certainly applies to many communities across the country and the world, we can take these measures to prevent something like Lahaina from happening on another main street here in the U.S.
Before we dive into the book, let's back up a bit to get a wider view of your career. You've covered a variety of important news stories, including the Sandy Hook shooting, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Syrian civil war, and the catastrophic 2010 Haiti earthquake. What was the tipping point that made you choose climate change as the subject of your first book?
I have always loved the natural world. It's a story and a journey for me that began as a kid growing up in the 90s in my town of Mount Kisco in New York State, about an hour outside of New York City on the Metro North, for anybody that may be familiar with it. Back then, if you were to go and ask my parents where I was when I had free time, I was most likely playing in the nearby woods. That's where I fell in love with the natural world. I went there and I would read, I would write, I would draw, listen to music, and daydream. I've said this before, those woods were like my church, a place to reflect and take stock. Those woods were also where I learned how fragile our ecosystem is, because around that same time, there was a housing development planned in those very woods. And it's also when I learned the power of words, specifically the written words in this case, because my parents, along with so many other people in the community, came together. And they wrote letters to local leaders protesting that development, specifically concerned about the local wetlands there and the impact this development would have on nesting birds in this case. And the lesson that I took away from this experience is words matter, because ultimately that development was scrapped. And today, when I go back to that very home that I grew up in, where my parents still live, I go and revisit those woods and I still daydream. And so that experience really sparked, I think, my drive to write. And eventually when I went to college to focus on journalism and photography, and I've always focused on similar environmental crossroads as a result, mainly driven by my love for the natural world. As you mentioned, some of the other kinds of stories that I've covered, from terrorist attacks to shootings, I don't always get to choose the stories that I follow, especially as a rookie reporter starting off in local news. But anytime I had an opportunity to choose the stories that I got to cover, I was always most focused on environmental stories. And for me, I think the real springboard into focusing primarily on environmental stories was actually Hurricane Sandy in New York City. I was working for WNBC, the NBC affiliate in New York, at the time, and was stationed in Queens along the coast when the storm hit. And it was myself and a photographer, Jeff Richardson, and we were mobile. We had what is known as a live view, which was kind of new at the time in 2013. It was this backpack that allowed us to essentially link up to any satellite or cell receiver to get a live signal out. And that storm and the storm surge that followed, it knocked offline a lot of the live trucks and satellite trucks that we had that allow other correspondents that I was with to go live. So we were one of the only teams that was actually able to get our reporting out because we had this backpack and we didn't get flooded out. And the devastation that I saw in the greatest city in the world with the best engineering, with incredible financing, to see a city knocked offline in the way that it was. I remember coming up to an intersection in Queens where there was an ambulance just right in the middle of the road. And at first we thought there were people responding to some kind of scene, some emergency. And I remember going to check in on this ambulance to see if anybody was there. And there was no one there. The keys were still in the ignition. The receiver for the radio communications was off. What this said to me as I looked at this and later inspected and saw that there was a water line about 7 feet above my head on this emergency vehicle, on this ambulance, they were caught off guard. They were probably flooded by the storm surge and had to evacuate. They couldn't even help people. So seeing the desperate state that New York was in, the inability to respond, we're talking days where we witnessed people piling along in long lines waiting to charge their cell phones. In one situation on the Lower East Side, close to where I lived, there was a dumpster outside one of the local grocery stores where workers had removed all of the expired food, and where residents, desperate for food because nothing was open, were actually picking through for anything that they could take home to eat or to drink to sustain themselves. Again, New York City, and this happened. And that just immediately triggered in my mind, what's to come next? This is obviously following Hurricane Katrina, other extreme weather events by different names. And it was really a sign at that point, if New York City wasn't prepared, what other communities, especially small town communities, are in the line of fire next? I would say that was the moment that I really decided to focus in on climate. From there, though, from New York, I was sent to London for the foreign correspondent position with CBS News, where I covered environmental stories overseas before returning back to the States to the West Coast Bureau for CBS, which really launched my time on the front lines of climate change fueled extreme weather events.
Your perspective as a reporter is really important. I think there can be a criticism of national news media that I am not always sympathetic to, but I think sometimes it does resonate, which is that because of the concentration of journalists and reporters in major cities, it can create blind spots from or biases towards those larger hubs, right? Whether that's in political reporting or even something like climate reporting, larger towns and cities tend to receive an outsized amount of national attention relative to where and who is impacted by the destruction. Mount Kisco has a population of about 11,000 people, and I imagine that growing up there played a significant role in your decision to focus on small towns in America for this book.
It did. And I also, having lived now in, I think, four different states, climbing the ladder that is television news, going from small market to big market to bigger market, I also, in that experience, fell in love with smaller communities across the country. That's where I find culture to thrive, where we can experience so much diversity, so many differences. When you go into a bigger city, it's a melting pot. Everybody starts to act the same. But when you go off into smaller communities, I feel like that's where I really get a sense of place and community. And each community in these smaller communities is so vastly different. When it comes to coverage, I think you're spot on. I think that bigger cities, and by its very nature, bigger populations, tend to get more of the spotlight when it comes to disasters of this scale. Specifically when we're talking about Hurricane Sandy, I was there on the ground reporting on the aftermath for weeks and months, years. And to this day, there is still coverage of the aftermath and lessons learned from Hurricane Sandy. Smaller communities are harder to get to and easier to forget. Smaller populations, less noise, if you will, coming out of them. So less of an alarm for us to listen to and to go back to and to continue to shine that spotlight. And why I focus specifically on small towns in terms of climate change and the impact climate change is having on radicalizing our weather, I see them as canaries in the coal mine. And what I mean by that is climate change is affecting every community, no matter how big, how small, a city, a village, an enclave, whatever it may be. But big cities have infrastructure. They have money. And obviously, that doesn't always work. We saw that, and I just expressed that with Hurricane Sandy. But still, because of all that money and infrastructure, they were able to rebound rather quickly. Smaller communities don't have that infrastructure. They don't have that financing. They don't have that tax base. So they feel the impacts of climate change in a way unlike any other big city. And to look and see what is happening there must serve as a warning to all of us, no matter where we live, but especially in bigger cities too, because what has happened into these smaller communities will happen to bigger communities as well, as Mother Nature outpaces man's ability to hold her back. Eventually, all of the marvels of engineering that have kept some of our greatest American cities alive, they're going to start to fail and collapse. And what happens when that does happen? And what can we learn from survivors in these smaller communities who have essentially given us a survivor's guide if we choose to listen?
You break out the environmental change that the Earth is experiencing into two distinct but related categories, climate change and habitat change. What is the difference between these two, and why did you decide to distinguish them from each other?
Well, I'm glad you recognize that. I tried as hard as I can to identify these two different kinds of changes. Because when there are multiple changes, yeah, I guess that poses multiple threats, but I see multiple solutions. So I was speaking to you about how climate change can be abstract. People struggle to process climate change, and the solutions can be daunting. And I understand why. Reversing the impacts of climate change requires the global community to come together and act as one to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, which are warming our atmosphere. And it's critical. We must address this. We must stop our dependence on fossil fuels. But even if we all globally stopped emitting greenhouse gases today, it will take time to see a positive impact on our climate because of what's known as a delayed feedback loop. And I liken this delayed feedback loop to taking aspirin for a headache. Just like it takes 30 minutes for that aspirin to kick in, the same is true, but much longer for climate change to reduce our planet's fever. It's going to take time. Scientists say it could take decades. But in the meantime, there is something we can do right now to make our communities more resilient to climate change and to the extreme weather that it's radicalized. And that's where I focus on habitat change and reversing our impacts to our habitats, to our communities, to the places we call home. And this goes back to Lahaina. We can restore our wetlands, protect our wetlands, protect our woodlands, like what I saw firsthand in Mount Kisco. We can reduce fire threats by removing dry invasive grasses. We can build our homes in safer places, out of harm's way, and in ways that make them stronger and more resilient to our radicalized weather. And we can do this if we inform people how to do so in ways that doesn't cost a lot of money, and in some cases where it doesn't cost anything at all when all is said and done. Through tax credits, a lot of these measures can be covered. And then, of course, you get to reduce the amount of money you're spending every single month on insurance rates. So I focus on habitat change because it gives power to the individual and it gives power to the individual community. You don't need the globe to buy into this idea. You just need many individuals. Back to the idea of this house with the red roof. If there were a number of homes with the red roof in a neighborhood, that neighborhood could potentially survive a disaster. If there was an entire community of homes with the red roof, they could potentially survive a disaster. A lot of this may sound like theory. I don't know if you remember Hurricane Ian, Fort Myers Beach, the devastation that was caused there. Well, not that far away from Fort Myers Beach is a planned community called Babcock Ranch. And again, this is a planned community built from scratch in an area that kept in mind the threat of rising sea levels, of flooding, of hurricanes, built on an elevated area. All of the power lines were underground. All of the materials were sustainable and storm resistant, I think up to a Category 3 hurricane. This was a place that took action, having seen the writing on the wall in other communities. And when Hurricane Ian hit, Babcock Ranch, just like the house with the red roof, except this was an entire community, Babcock Ranch survived, largely unscathed, no flooding, very little damage. They never lost power. You compare that to Fort Myers Beach, which not that far away was decimated. And so I think working with our habitat, remembering that habitat change is another dual threat and seeing it as another possible solution is the key to building resilience in the future that we face with climate change, at least the immediate future.
When it comes to the topic of climate change, I feel like it leads to very extreme discussions. Either on one end of the spectrum, you have people saying that our Earth is going to completely end in 10 years if we don't take the most drastic, sometimes controversial action possible. On the other hand, you have people who, even if they don't deny climate change, often feel like they just check out. Because at the heart of it, preventing global climate change, to your point, Jonathan, is really a collective action problem. It requires so many different nations to coordinate together, or even just our one nation to work together in lockstep to get things done. So I really appreciate that you spend so much of the book focusing on habitat change and showing that there is so much that can be done to adapt, mitigate, protect, and save our local environments.
You know, it's so interesting because when you talk about this confusion, and I think you're right, there is so much confusion surrounding climate change. It's also been a politicized crisis, which I don't think it needs to be or should be politicized. But in all of this confusion around climate change and the controversy now surrounding it because of how political it's gotten, there is this vacuum that's created, a vacuum of information or lack thereof. And in that vacuum, you have all these wild ideas and conspiracies that spring up. But if we could work better, and I say this as myself, as a journalist, somebody that's a storyteller that's trying to help connect the dots to how our world works, if we could do a better job at linking climate science in a clear and understandable way to the threats that our communities currently face, I think that vacuum will disappear and people will start to understand. I was listening to a TED Talk. I feel like you're a fan of TED Talks. I won't quiz you on this, though. There is a psychologist out of Harvard, Dan Gilbert.
I love Daniel Gilbert. I was just speaking about him with neuroscientist Tally Sherritt.
He's fantastic. And forgive me because I don't know the year. I think it was like 2007 or 2008. I watched it on YouTube years later.
I've watched it like a dozen times. Yeah.
And he's given a few of them. This one was on the key to happiness. And he was specifically talking about the prefrontal cortex. And I know I'm trying to simplify things and I'm throwing out big words that I barely understand. As he described it, it's this part of the brain that is unique to us humans, unlike any other animal in the kingdom. And it gives us this power to imagine. And it is this adaptation that allows us, essentially prevents us, I should say, from doing stupid things. And this part of our brain is triggered in part through storytelling, stories shared to us by friends, family, and journalists. And the more we tell these stories clearly, the more we're able to turn this imagination on, that part of our brain that lets us see things before they happen. As I was writing this book, it was in the back of my head, and I just did some research because I was thinking about those anti-smoking campaigns that you see on television. I don't write about this in the book, but it's something that I was just thinking of. And you've probably seen one of these campaigns. It usually features somebody in some state of suffering warning somebody else not to pick up a pack of cigarettes. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
So in New York City, the health department there found for every dollar it spent on its campaign, It saved $32 in medical costs. So it was incredibly effective because the images were very clear. The message was very clear. But for some reason, when it comes to climate change and how oftentimes it can be abstract and how the solutions can seem daunting, it seems like we have, most of us, turned this part of our brain that allows us to imagine off. And there's a perfect example of this, just looking at the numbers, real estate. There's a real estate risk management firm called Aon that tracks where people move. And they found in the past 40 years, 6 times more people move to risky, threatened coastal communities, threatened specifically by hurricanes and flooding, than they did to nearby inland areas that were much safer. Now, these aren't people, I would think, that are looking to specifically put themselves, their family, their investment in harm's way. After all, so many people have a 30-year mortgage, and I would like to think they assume that they're going to be there in place for at least 30 years. I think these are people that just haven't listened, not because they don't want to listen, but because the message that they have been told time and time again just isn't connecting with them. And so as I was writing this book, and I spent 3 years doing so, I tried to connect the dots in a way that I hoped would help people not just listen, but also understand and digest the threat that is climate change in a way that seems surmountable and possible.
Well, and what I enjoyed so much about it is that you were specific. It's a tough issue, right? But I feel like a lot of the messaging at the national level anyway is just very general, right? So when someone hears the global temperatures over the next 50 or 100 years are going to rise 1 degree, that's really abstract for people. But when you get into these specific on-the-ground scenarios about here's what's happening to this community in Alaska, here's what's happening to this community in California, here's what's happening to this community in Louisiana, it hammers home the fact that, one, these are the real immediate impacts of a changing climate. Here are the people that are being affected by them, and here's what we can do to prevent further catastrophe. And the book is both an on-the-ground account of the climate disasters that are happening today, but also something I really enjoyed. It's a rich look into the history that got us to where we are today. And you've broken the book into 4 sections, one for each of the 4 elements of nature: earth, air, fire, and water. And you lead with fire. In 1935, the U.S. Forest Service established what is called the 10 a.m. policy. I'd love for you to share with our listeners what it is and how it relates to how we're dealing with forest fires 89 years later.
Let me take you on a little journey here. So back in the 1800s in what is today the state of California, fire was a very known presence along all of the landscape. 12% of what is today California was covered in slow-moving, low-intensity fires, part of the ecology. These fires would burn and remove dead vegetation and make way for new, healthier growth. In the 1900s, as you point out, the Forest Service then steps in. As the population is growing, it becomes their mission to protect the forests, and in doing so, protect the lumber industry and also protect the growing communities on the forest floor. And they established the 10 a.m. policy, which essentially said, after they created their first wildland firefighters, you have to put out every fire before 10 a.m. the next day. This is what we call fire suppression. And it was incredibly successful for the past 100 years or so. Fires would start, firefighters would move in, and they would put out the flames. But in doing so, especially after decade after decade after decade, you had vegetation that naturally was supposed to burn that was instead collecting. So what was inadvertently happening was we were creating a tinderbox, and in this case, an entire state in a tinderbox state. Then you get to the turn of this century, and this is where we were starting to witness man being outpowered by Mother Nature, because when a fire started, the fire would rip through with high intensity this decades-long backlog of dry vegetation, creating these kinds of mega fires that even firefighters were struggling to hold back. Unfortunately, a perfect example is the tragedy that unfolded with the campfire in Paradise, California, in 2018. The fire started blown by intense wind through woodlands that had not experienced wildfire in decades. And because of all of the dry vegetation and fuel, this fire burned so hot, it destroyed so many lives so quickly. Back in the 1800s, the fires were so low in their intensity, only about, according to research, 10% of trees in an impacted wildfire area were destroyed. In 2021, by contrast, in the Dixie Fire, you had 90%, that's 90% of trees impacted that died. That's how hot these fires today are now burning, in part because of this 10 a.m. policy. And on top of that, what strikes me is the giant sequoias, because they're a perfect landmark in many ways, but specifically when we were talking about losing our grip on Mother Nature. Sequoias have been around, some are as old as 3,000 years old. So put it like that. They have 2 feet thick bark with tannin, which is a chemical that pumps through their veins, and it's fire retardant. So when a fire hits the base of a sequoia, generally these trees survive. They don't have any issue. But fires are burning so hot now that even those natural defenses aren't enough. And in 2020, during the Castle Fire, 10,000 giant sequoias, 10% of the population of these trees, died off because of how high intensity today's fires are.
The book is filled with just alarming stat after alarming stat. Quote, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, California's wetlands have shrunk by 90% since the 1800s, around the time beavers started vanishing from the landscape, end quote. I'd love for you to talk a bit about beaver dam speed bumps and why they're so closely related to the American West's habitat change.
I love beavers, and I never gave much credit or much thought to the beaver before doing this story. So beavers are eco-engineers. They're an amazing species, what's known as a keystone species, because they're able to build environments that sustain other species. And a few years ago, a researcher by the name of Emily Fairfax, who I profile in my book, she discovered while responding to the aftermath of a wildfire that there was this lush area of green, moist vegetation, rich with water, a wetland that had preserved and protected acres of land from this fire that destroyed everything else around it. And she found at the center of all of this was a beaver dam. And beavers, as she discovered, create beaver speed bumps, which, unlike the concrete dams we humans build, these speed bumps allow water to filter through and allow an ecosystem to continue to grow. But at the same time, they slow that water down so that it can percolate through the soil, refresh the aquifer, and create environments that are incredibly vibrant. And so a species that once was nearly hunted to extinction for its fur is now in California revered for this ability to conserve water, especially in a state that needs more of it. Initially, and this is still a threat today, it's not like the beaver is universally celebrated. Initially, beavers were taken off land by homeowners because of the threat of flooding that they posed. But now, in light of this research, and because of a drought and because of the scarcity and value in water, landowners, some of them who initially kicked beavers out of their land, are now welcoming them back in so that they can conserve water in those regions. And unfortunately, because we have altered our wetlands so much and we've redirected waterways, a lot of the rivers where beavers would naturally take root and build their dams, they're too low in water and flow for these beavers to survive on their own. So now there's a team of people and organizations across the West that go into certain areas where landowners are requesting beavers, and they build what are known as beaver analog dams, which is a fancy way of saying beaver dams built by humans. And I went for one of my stories for the CBS Evening News and for the Morning News program to help build one of these dams and release two beavers into it so they could take root and build their own ecosystem. And it was incredible to see the release of these beavers as they made their way into this ecosystem that was supported by our hands so they could take root and start to conserve water as they naturally do. And more now, there's even a state effort that is funded by state money to introduce more beavers to the landscape in hopes that all of that water conservation that they naturally do will make for more vibrant and resilient ecosystems and communities.
I spoke with wildlife biologist and Animal Planet host Forrest Galante last year about keystone species, and it's amazing how ignorant we were not too long ago about the vital role that animals played and play in maintaining our environment. But I guess it's at least heartening that it's better late than never.
I agree. And I think that's the message on climate change and habitat change too. It's okay for what has happened. We got to this point, what we call progress, because of the things that we have done in the past. And we live much longer lives, much healthier lives in some cases than we used to 50, 100 years ago. But it is not okay to now know things and to continue on as if it's business as usual. We have to seek out information. As a journalist, we have to provide clear information. And to possess this information and to have this knowledge and not do anything, that's where I think it's wrong. But the good news is today is a fresh day and we can pick up the pieces and we can make our lives much safer by taking small steps. I think the first step is recognizing maybe we're not living in the most sustainable way in some places. You don't need to look far to see that perhaps some areas weren't the best places to build communities and to build families. Now, with that said, these communities aren't going anywhere. So it's time now to do your due diligence and take measures that will protect these communities. Because to sit back and to do nothing and to continue business as usual, I think it's just going to present more and more risks for more communities down the road. We see it every year. You know, I pinball around the country covering every kind of extreme weather event from big communities to small communities. And every single place I've ever been, you don't hear somebody say, I knew this was coming. Everybody I've spoken with says, we thought that this was never going to happen to us. We never imagined this. We never imagined this. And it's a problem with imagination and with messaging.
Well, and I don't know if you'll take to this comparison, but I think we need more climate change Paul Revere's that are warning people, hey, the British aren't just coming, they're here. It's a communication issue. One of the things that I've spoken about at length with different guests is a lot of these problems come down to oftentimes a lack of communication from the people we either elect to lead us or look to lead us, unelected leaders, whether it was around the COVID vaccines or science misinformation, which has been a topic I've touched on several times. People don't know what they don't know. And oftentimes those can lead to really dangerous circumstances.
It's a really great point. So there is, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Media and Climate Change Observatory of the University of Colorado Boulder. It's an organization that tracks the media's coverage of climate change month after month, year after year. They've been doing this for decades. So bear with me as I give you a timeline. January of 2000. They found all of the major television networks only aired 26 stories on climate change. You mentioned Paul Revere. I'll mention another name, Al Gore, 2006, comes out with An Inconvenient Truth. And for the first time, we saw climate science in action as he connected the data to real-time events and disasters. And it opened the media's eyes, and it changed the way the media covered it. And as a result, opened up listeners, viewers' eyes. In January of 2007, after the documentary came out, the same observatory found that more than 260 stories on climate change aired across all of the major networks. So that's a 1,000% spike. And today, more than 600 stories on climate change in some months air across all of the major networks. And this has had tremendous impact because there's also polling dating back to 2000 that showed only 5% of people knew a lot about climate change when polled. Today, more than 50% of people consider climate change a major threat. That has changed because of the way the media now covers it and hopefully making it more digestible and easier to understand. But obviously, there is a lot of room for progress. We need to work harder at how we link the climate science to the real world events that are happening. And I am guilty of being bad at this in the past. When I was initially covering extreme weather events, even looking back at Hurricane Sandy, I never once mentioned climate change. I never once in all of the disasters that I was seeing when I was making my way through New York City mentioned climate change as a threat that really pushed this kind of storm to the megastorm status that it was. But now I make an effort, and I can't do it in every single story, especially when it's breaking news and you're first focused on the emergency response. But in the days that follow in my reporting, I make a point to make it clear that what we are seeing is what scientists have linked clearly to climate change. I always try to reference the science in doing so, but I now make it a point because I think it's very important that we don't treat these storms as singular, isolated events. They're all interconnected, And they're all connected to climate science.
I've said on this podcast before that I was once guilty of referring to the entire middle of the country. And I think this is just a problem that one can encounter when they grow up in California. And it is something that I'm still repenting for. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, my friends and I would refer to the entire middle section of the country as the, quote, flyover states. I am actively disabusing myself of that language because I understand now how condescending it is. You know, many of my friends here in Los Angeles are self-described liberal or progressive, but I have relatives that are spread throughout rural California and in small towns around America who are conservative. And I want to take their viewpoint seriously because for most of my life, I didn't. And I still regret that because I just personally feel it's arrogant and disrespectful of me to do so. I think some of their concerns around climate messaging, and I don't disagree with all of them, is that a lot of it is overly doom and gloom, which your book does not do. I think your book prescribes real, tangible, often extremely achievable solutions that on the local level can help prevent these disasters, right? While acknowledging that there is global and national action needed to actually prevent climate change from continuing. But I feel like a lot of the national coverage that I'll see in print or online is, I think, unnecessarily extremist in its prescriptions. The one critique that I've heard of Al Gore's movie from the 2000s is that some of his predictions just simply did not come true. And I think that what happens in those situations is when people are already skeptical of the messaging, if they brand it left wing, and this happens the other direction as well, you'll have people on the left who Donald Trump could say the sky is blue, and there are going to be people who just are politically not aligned with him who are going to insist the sky is not blue. And so I think one of them is who is sending out the message, right? And if they're coded as the opposite political party, the message will be ignored. It's why I had on a spokesperson for a conservative climate action committee early on in this podcast, because I feel like you need to not only meet people where they're at, but the people who are speaking to those people need to sometimes be from the same side of the political aisle. But I think more importantly, as it relates to this book, Jonathan, is I feel like a lot of the messaging around climate change is way too doomerism, and there's not enough actual prescriptions involved that the average American can put to practice in their day-to-day life.
I think that's fair. I do think fear is a powerful motivator, but I have always found that hope at the end of the day is what inspires people to take action. Fear for a lot of people can be paralyzing. Hope can be freeing. And I think it's important to hear everyone's perspective, everyone's side. And I also understand predictions that are made and they don't come true. That can turn people off and it can make people think, what am I even listening to? Of course, it's hard to say if any of the things that were discussed in a documentary in 2006, perhaps that led to some change that prevented some of those forecasted outcomes. I think the hope that I try to embed in every page of my book is, why not do what is best for a community, regardless of the outcome, regardless of if that community is ever going to be threatened by a weather event? It is hard to forecast where these storms go, where they land, where they impact the hardest. But it's like taking vitamins. You take vitamins to protect yourself, to make sure you're nourished, to be healthier, and it's preventative. I think we should all be doing the same in our communities to make them resilient to the test of time. You want a home that is going to perhaps be passed down to the next generation. You want to see your children have children. You want them to thrive. I think focusing on the hope, focusing on the action that can be taken, I don't think you need to hit people over the head with climate change and climate science and all of these things that honestly even make my brain numb sometimes. I think it's about focusing on the tangible and the things that we can do to protect ourselves. So I moved into my home in Hollywood just before COVID. In doing so, I learned how tricky it can be to get affordable insurance because of the threat of wildfires. And my home actually is very low risk of a wildfire because here in Hollywood, I'm surrounded by a lot of concrete. I've got trees and everything, but I'm surrounded by a lot of concrete. So knock on wood, my neighborhood is pretty well protected.
But hopefully not too much wood.
Yeah, hopefully not too much wood. And with that said, I took some of my own advice in this book. If you come to my house, you'll still think I have a lot of work to do in terms of removing some overgrown trees and overgrown brush and shrubs. But I still created as best I could a defensible space around my home. Not because I even think that there's a major threat facing my home, but why not do it? Why not take the steps that are simple, that are within my power? And by the way, removing some of this brush and removing some of these overgrown trees also reduces the termite risk to my home. So I'm just doing things that I know will make my home last longer, I hope. It's a 100-year-old home. It needs some love and support. And I'm just trying to do those things to make this home carry on. Am I doing it because of the climate threat? Sure, that's in the back of my head, but there are other things too. I want my insurance bill to go down. Great way of doing that. I want to make sure I don't have a termite infestation. That's no fun. I've seen people tent their homes, so I'm glad I did it. I think people need to see that sometimes taking some of these solutions to ward off any kind of extreme weather event, which is really the case in my book, there are other positives that all of these moves will make in other ways in other people's lives.
I recently spoke with senior Reuters correspondent Ernest Scheider, who wrote The War Below, Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. It's an up-close look at the tensions that have arisen between those who champion lithium, copper, and cobalt mining, materials for our audience that are necessary to power our green, renewable future, and those who oppose it, environmentalists, conservationists, and often indigenous tribes. And as you note in Before It's Gone, Native Americans are historically, repeatedly the victims of American expansion and industrialization. And now, often as a result of that history, they're the most vulnerable to habitat and climate change. What's at stake for them?
Great question. And so much is at stake for them. And they have been marginalized and oftentimes forgotten. I think that's very fair to say. What's at stake for them is their culture, their tradition, which so much of it has already been lost because it is so intertwined with the land. They stand to lose even more of it. I was in Alaska near Fairbanks doing a story on the boreal forest and a new plan there to turn some of that land over to farmers who will tear down the boreal forest, which is a carbon sequestering forest. It sequesters a ton. We're talking millions of tons of CO2 every year. And there are plans now, and they're being activated to sell off hundreds of thousands of acres for farming. These are the same acres that the Nenana tribe that I visited use for sustainable living, for subsistence living, where they go and they hunt, they fish. Everything that makes up their livelihoods comes from this forest.
There was a quote from the book that really stood out to me where they said, quote, "This land, this is our grocery store."
It is their grocery store. You read the book. Thank you.
I try.
It is their grocery store, and they have been pushed to marginalized land where they thought they would be safe. And here we are now in 2024, and a tribe that never once thought that they would have to fight to protect their grocery store is now having to fight and protect their grocery store because climate change has warmed up Alaska faster than any other state in the country in a way now where this land can be harvested and turned into agricultural land. And sure, it can help feed the mouths of many in Alaska. And even the Nana tribe recognizes the need to have sustainable farming within the state. But their question as this now even more marginalized community is, do you need to do it in a place as ecologically sensitive and significant as the boreal forest? So that's just one small window into the life of a tribe that has been fighting for its piece of the pie of the land for centuries. And here they are on yet another front line fighting for something that they never once imagined they'd have to fight for, because previously it was too cold to even think about growing anything in the boreal forest. But now, because it's warm enough, their livelihood is threatened.
One of my very first memories involved my father. I was 3 years old. We were sitting on the floor of my parents' new townhome in Pleasanton, Northern California, and he had out a typewriter. I was sitting next to him on the floor. We still had boxes everywhere from the stuff that like I was going to help unpack at 3 years old, that we had yet to unpack. And we sat next to each other. I told him stories about Superman and Batman and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and he would type them out on his typewriter and then read them back to me. And hearing my father read my stories back in his voice, the voice of my hero, was one of the things that inspired me to pursue a career in storytelling and brought me here to Los Angeles. And so my question to you, Jonathan, is you dedicated your book to your father, quote, who said one day I'd write a book, end quote. Why did you decide to dedicate the book to your dad, and what does he mean to you?
You're going to make me choke up. My father is someone who I love dearly and who I also take for granted. In my mind that fails to acknowledge that there will be a day without him, I pretend that he's always going to be around, and therefore I can reach out to him tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. He sent me a text message with a story idea. Thanks, Dad. I'll get to that. My entire life, my father has been my champion. He's the one that introduced me to the Boy Scouts, which also really fueled my love for the outdoors and for nature. And through it all, he has always encouraged my love for storytelling, for journalism, and for journaling. I have probably 20 journals that I have written in at the end of every assignment I'll reflect. I probably have 50 of just journals that I write in for fun and just to reflect. And my father was the one that told me, write down your experiences, keep a journal. He introduced that to me and through it all said, one day you're going to write a book. One day you're going to write a book and use it to make a change, to make a difference. And so just like with the story ideas my father sends me that I roll my eyes at and say, sure, Dad, I'll get to it. When he told me I was going to write a book, I was like, yeah, Dad, sure. And then here I am 3 years, I'm talking to you from the desk where I wrote this book for most of the time. As I wrapped up this book, I just thought to myself, my dad was right. And so it seemed right to dedicate it to him.
The older I get, the more I come to truly understand how important it is to appreciate the people we love before they're gone.
Yes, well said.
For our final question, I'd love to tie it to your childhood love of journaling to your career now. And I want to put a question to you that I put to a friend of mine who was once an EMT, a job that I would never in a million years have the heart or stomach for. As I mentioned at the start of our conversation, you've covered crises across multiple continents. Journalists report on such a wide variety of topics, politics, sports, entertainment, business, technology, just to name a few. What interested you in, or perhaps the better question is, what called you to stories that so often involve such intense physical and emotional trauma?
I am always amazed and inspired by the people that I have met while in this case specifically covering extreme weather. These are, I call them survivors often, but they're people that have just lived through the worst moments in their life and in these moments have chosen to share with me their experiences. Their stories have, and I said this earlier with you, have served as a survival guide to myself. So many people I've met have, not even knowing it, taught me how to cope with the pressures of the job, the pressures of life. If they can pick up the pieces and move on, then what I have faced, which is far less extreme, is surmountable. I can get through it. And I feel like I meet these people in the most stripped down version of themselves in their lives. And I connect with them on a level I've never connected with anybody else. I don't think I've sought out any of these stories for that specific kind of connection. I go and chase after these storms in my bigger effort to, for myself, witness and learn about our climate crisis. But I think one of the fortunate takeaways from all of this are the incredible people I've met along the way, and many of them I try to profile in this book. They are survivors. They offer survivor guides for all of us. And perhaps even more importantly, they're America's new kind of pioneer that is paving a new way forward for themselves, for their communities, and if we listen, for us too.
On that note, Jonathan, I want to end with a brief passage from Before It's Gone, in which you describe 14-year-old Cindy Miller of Leesville, Louisiana, who was 2020 Hurricane Laura's first confirmed fatality when a tree crashed through the roof of her family's home. Quote, at just over 5 feet tall, she almost disappeared into a room if you weren't looking closely. But to find her and to lock your eyes with hers, framed by delicate glasses, was not just to feel seen, but perhaps even understood. She had a weightless and comforting presence about her. She'd been called a perceptive soul. It was a superpower of hers, honed by years of being bullied by a few classmates who mistook her placid nature for weakness, end quote. Before It's Gone is, As I've said, part detailed history lesson, part character-driven personal account, and part urgent call to action. But what stood out most to me was how the compassion for your subjects comes across in your empathetic descriptions of their lives. So Jonathan, thank you for bringing our attention to the people most affected by these crises, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's my honor to be here. I really appreciate it.